Hello, and welcome once again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. We are reading The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere by Deborah Marquardt. It was published in 2006 by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group in New York. We resume our reading at the point where Deborah and her husband are on their way to her father's funeral, and she is talking about her reactions to this occurrence. I thought of my father's body dressed in a blue suit, lying parallel to the horizon inside a steel-blue coffin lined with satin. I didn't want to see his hands held together in eternal prayer, a black rosary wound around his fingers. I didn't want to shake the thin, sympathetic hand of the undertaker or admire the sheaf of wheat bound with a blue ribbon and placed inside his coffin. I didn't want to overhear family, friends marvel at how good he looks, and I did not want my mother to force me to get up close and stroke his lapel one last time before they closed the lid for good. I wanted to remember those hands shuffling a deck of cards, dealing 10 to me, 10 to him, picking up spares and slapping down discards as he looked to complete his run of queens or diamonds or hearts. And when I snapped my fan of cards down on the table and gave him my rummy smile, I wanted him to rise again and scream in playfulness, "You had my gin card!" and chase me around the house with a shoe until my mother made us stop. I wanted to remember him scruffing the top of my head, messing my hair, boxing my ears, and saying, "Ah, you're just a rotten kid." "Wah!" I wanted to protest back. "I am not!" I wanted to picture him anywhere but the Nickish funeral parlor, on the couch at home with the remote in his hand, or in the hospital after his last heart attack with the plunger in his hand, calling for more medication. One spring morning when I was about 13, my mother asked me to drive the pickup to the North Field to take my father his lunch. He had been seeding the land for weeks, and this quarter section was the last to be done. The water levels were high that year, and this particular field had a slope and a small spring in the center. Even under normal conditions, it never dried to more than a slough halfway through the summer. My father adored straight, even rows, and he loathed wasted acreage. Each year he circled the wet spot, seeding as close in as possible. How many times as a child had I seen him walking home after he had gotten the tractor stuck near that spring. From the second story of our farmhouse, I could observe him a mile away, walking along the section line, his short legs jutting sharply in front of him as he stamped toward the yard to get another tractor to pull the first tractor out. When he'd get closer, you could see he'd be swinging his seed cap by his side. And with his hat off, you could make out the leathery, sunburned darkness of his face, smudged and dirty from planting, set against the pallor of his bone-white forehead. The one place that lived a pristine, sunless life under the constant protection of his seed cap. And when he'd get close enough to be addressed, my mother would dare to ask, "What happened?" And he'd storm by and shout, "God damn it!" That day, when I drove out to my father in the North Field, I sat on the gravel road in the pickup with the cooler beside me on the seat. I watched my dad go around in circles, seeding the circumference of the springy spot. It was common to have to wait like this. Farming was serious business, and you were just a kid. You could afford to wait and listen to the radio until the next row was finished. He circled and circled with the tractor, then got too close to the spring, cut too deep with one of the big back tires its deep grooves spinning in place, clogged and slick with dark mud. He was trying to back his way out of the mess when he jackknifed the cedar attached to the tractor, and his other back wheel slid down the incline into the mud. The angry groan of the tractor's engine roared against the quiet backdrop of the morning. The grinding gears gnashed as he rocked the tractor back and forth. The wheels dug down in search of pay dirt, anything solid for the deep rubber grooves to catch on. But the tires only spun around, smooth and mud-caked. And just when he was about to give up, just about to cut the engine, pull the brake, and hop down off the tractor, I saw the front end begin to elevate. First, the front tires lifted off the ground. Then the front end rose higher and higher, carrying my father into the air. It happened so slowly, there was time to contemplate the outcome. Would the balance shift and the tractor flip backward over him? This is the most common story of the plains, the blood sacrifice. Every year, some farmer must die on his machinery. My father grasped the steering wheel and slowly stood up, leaning his small body forward to counteract the light front end. I watched all this from the pickup, unable to move or help. It was a moment of sheer weights and balances, the physical world ticking off its equations, none of which included me. I turned off the radio and waited with my fingers on the door handle. And that is when my father looked in my direction to see if I was registering all this. Our eyes met, and I could see that he wasn't frightened at all, that he was just his usual self, small and fierce and impatient to know what would happen next. That's the way I want to imagine him that last day in the hospital, except for the beeping equipment and the health workers trying to save his life. He was alone. But I want to be there floating above him, and when that part of him that is now gone begins to lift up, I want to meet his eyes so that I am the last thing he sees, so that he will remember me, the daughter who watches silently by the side of the road, the one who is getting this all down. At 9:30 on the morning of my father's funeral, I told my husband to turn our van around, to abandon our spot in the column of cars accumulating on the shoulder, waiting for the house on the road to pass. The starter zinged to action, and he pulled onto the lane, making a textbook three-point turn on the highway. My strategy was to circumnavigate the house on the road by driving the section lines. As a kid, I had driven the pickup along these back roads, taking lunch out to the men in the fields. As a teenager, I had brought carloads of friends out here to find a safe place to drink and party. As a young woman, I had directed men out here to park. For over 20 years since leaving home, I have driven past this land on Highway 3, never once bothering to wander from the safety of the paved road. But surely, I thought, even after all these years, I could navigate the back roads of my own family land. A few hundred feet ahead of us was the turnoff to a section line I remembered driving as a child. It was marked by 2 15-foot pillars of rocks in the corner of the field. "There," I pointed, "turn in there." Every North American generation of my family has contributed layers to those rock piles. The largest stones forming the base were hauled with oxen from the fields by my great-grandparents in the initial land clearing. The ones in the middle were moved with horses by my grandparents. The ones near the top were gathered by tractor and placed there by my immediate family each year as we picked rocks. From inside the air-conditioned van, I studied the pillars as we turned onto the section line. My palms began to sweat. A heat rose in my body. In one rush, I remembered what it had taken out of our youthful skins to gather and collect those stones. In the bright morning light, the piles gleamed like shrines. Slowly, I began to discern the shapes of three red foxes reclining among the rocks. They were blending into the cracks, sunning themselves on the warm stones. They followed our slow movement with a wary gaze, licking their silky gold coats with their long snouts. We stared back in silence as we turned off the highway. The morning took on a strange feel. The first thing we noticed was that the dirt roads we were driving quickly lost their shoulders. Then the two grassy tire tracks dwindled down to one lane. Now we are on our way, I thought, going deeper into the middle of nowhere. As each road disappeared, I instructed my husband to turn onto another lane, and then another. Each dwindled into a grassy path. How could this be? What had become of the solid grid of section lines? I looked around and realized how much the shape of the land had changed in the 25 years since I had driven these back roads. The strict squares of my father's wheat and flax crops had turned into roving, fenceless fields of grass. Then I remembered my mother commenting during a long-ago phone conversation, "The first thing my brother did when he took over the farm was to get rid of all the domestic animals and tear down all the fences." My brother explained later that he had turned some of the land over to the Conservation Reserve Program, the CRP, which gives farmers financial incentives to take their land out of production and seed it back to grass. It was a good program for my brother, who in early spring could calculate the cost to seed, fertilize, and harvest a crop for one season, and know, not even factoring in the cost of his own labor, that the current wheat prices would not allow him to break even. So the CRP is good for the farmers, good for the wetlands and the waterfowl. It's good for the land itself, leaving acres fallow, so they can recover from years of production. And it's good for the root system, inhibiting erosion by preventing the spill-off of topsoil. With the annual crops, had gone the need to drive heavy equipment through the sections on a regular basis, and so the roads had begun to disappear. We came to a halt, finally, on a section line that had looked promising, but then we saw that in the distance the road dipped into a large pool of standing water. On the other side of the incline, we could see the track of the road leading out of the puddle and proceeding over another rise. "I think I can make it," my husband said, revving the engine to get a running start. "No," I screamed, as he began to downshift. I could imagine us walking the 3 miles through the fields in our formal black clothes, me in my black spiked heels. We had reached a dead end, it was clear. We sat there and appreciated our stuckness. The land spread around us for miles, a silent, watching presence. In parts of North Dakota, when the sun touches just right off the fields of wheat, oats, and flax, the view most resembles an ocean. The young men of my state, who ride high over the rolling gold fields, harvesting wheat on long, hot August days, admit to hallucinating, not waves of wheat, but great rippling bodies of water. The pioneers, especially those who had recently made an ocean crossing, saw the sea in the level plains and mixed grass prairies they encountered when they first arrived. "I believe this was once the bottom of a great inland sea," one pioneer woman observed in her journal as she crossed Kansas territory. Her observation was correct. Somewhere around 100 million years ago, much of the interior of what is now the United States, including North Dakota, was submerged under a shallow ocean extending in fragments from the Gulf of Mexico to the Arctic Ocean. In the North Dakota Geological Survey Office, it is possible to see on display fossil remnants of oceanic creatures that have been recovered from fields. This Great Cretaceous Sea, as geologists have called it, divided the continent into eastern and western shores and deposited several strata of shale and a condensed layering of mud and clay that even today, when the layers are penetrated through digging, reveal the fossils and remains of oysters, fish, crocodiles, sharks, and extinct animals such as diving birds and swimming reptiles that inhabited only seawater areas. North Dakota's first state geologist, A.G. Leonard, wrote that about 65 million years ago, the sea withdrew from North Dakota, never to return. Within the last 2 or 3 million years during the Pleistocene epoch, the topography of the Midwest was transformed again by what geologists call the Great Ice Plow-Up, the movement of glaciers that smoothed and flattened the land to its present state of undulating hills and ridges and deep sinuses of level earth. The most recent glaciation, the Wisconsinan, began approximately 70,000 years ago and ended 10,000 years ago, carrying and spreading rocks from as far away as the Hudson Bay. It's difficult to imagine the power of glaciers, a heavy wall of ice, hundreds of feet high, that pushes massive boulders thousands of miles, grinding them to fine powder. Geologists explain that as the glacier moves, the weight of the ice forces the materials on the bottom to creep forward toward the margins of the glacier, spreading deeper and wider across the landmass, dropping debris as it goes. Under the crushing weight of this ice, the earth is flattened and smoothed, and the boulders that move and clash are eventually ground down to the size of small stones and pebbles. Massive rocks are reduced to dirt so fine that it sifts like flour through one's fingers. The glacial drift that was left behind is a heterogeneous mixture of limestone, clay, shale, gravel, and pulverized boulders of quartzite, granite, and hornblende. The drift that remains makes up the flat, farmable plain of central North Dakota that, by some estimates, goes to depths of hundreds of feet in parts of the state. Part of this till is the topsoil that fed me in my youth and has sustained my family now for 4 generations. I knew these gravel roads and fields first as a flaming, impatient youth, a restless teenager, scanning the horizon for all possible methods of escape. For the next 25 years, I knew them through the airtight windows of cars, arming myself like an astronaut entering a rarefied environment, only returning home for the most necessary or solemn occasions. On the morning of my father's funeral, as we were stranded on the section line, I looked around and tried to imagine what it would be like to live out your whole life, as my parents and grandparents had, in one place, to walk and drive its length every day of every season, to be loath to leave it, to know all its turnings in every kind of weather, the colors that its slopes take on, to know its plants and trees, its smells and tendencies, where it drains and thrives, and where it gathers water and fails to produce. My father loved this gentle bowl of land with a devotion and intensity usually reserved for wives and children. Between the land in Bryant Township, where my father was born and raised, and the land northeast in Streeter Township, where my mother was born and raised, everything of significance that has happened to my family on this continent in the last 100 years has happened on that 25-mile-by-25-mile grid of land. On the day of my father's funeral, I looked around at the acres of wind-blown grass. I breathed deep and said to my father, who was a trickster in life, "Okay, what are you trying to show me?" I looked to the right and noticed for the first time an abandoned farmstead. The buildings were broken down to partial frames and toppling foundations. From what remained, I could see it had been a two-room shack with a small barn and a chicken coop set deep back in the lot. Somewhere behind the small stand of trees, there was likely to be a small grouping of shallow, unmarked graves. Someone's stillborn child, or a great-grandmother buried in a spot no one knows to visit. The tripod of the windmill rose into the sky. Only a few of the weathered tines hung on, long ago abandoning all hope of catching the necessary wind to bring water up from a well. From the architecture of the ruin, it was possible to date the period of abandonment as the early 1900s. Here was someone's 40 acres and a mule, a hopeful beginning, followed by an anonymous, tragic ending. The Midwest is full of them. Take any back road off a paved highway, and you'll see this scene repeated again and again. The people who once lived here are known forever to no one, and they belong nowhere. The land spread around us too capable of returning all stories to silence. While we who survive on this land fear losing ourselves to it, those of us who run away are never free of it. That morning, I thought about what geologists say. It's likely that we're in the middle of an interglacial, and that the ice will come again, crush through, brush, and plane down this land to new, unrecognizable shapes. In geological time, thousands to millions of years, I realize this is nothing I need to worry about, but I think about the generations of my family who have dedicated their lives to keeping our name tied to this parcel of land for 110 years, using all their strength, resources, energy, and imagination to outwit the forces, natural or otherwise, that would so easily strip us of this sense of belonging. And I think about how I have benefited from the sense of rootedness that this place has afforded me as I have cast about, rootless in the world. That morning we left the abandoned farmstead behind. We put the van in reverse and backed out of the dead-end road. We made our way back to the highway through the maze of fading and disappearing paths. At the intersection with the rock piles, we saw the three smiling foxes. They turned their heads and watched us idle by again, going in the other direction. We arrived at the intersection of Highway 3, just in time to see the house on the road pass by in solemn procession, with its entourage of bucket trucks and moving company pickups. I looked at the clock in the dashboard. It was only 9:40. Amazing! We would make it in time for the funeral. After the house on the road was safely passed, we pulled onto Highway 3, rolled up the windows, turned on the AC, and cruised into town. Several times in the years since that morning, I have returned to that section line and turned by the pillars of rock. The stones are still there, but never the smiling foxes. I have passed up and down those roads looking for the disappearing set of pathways, and for the abandoned farmstead my husband and I encountered that morning. A few times I've asked my brother to drive that countryside with me. It's his land now. He knows every inch of it. He slips his rifle in the gun rack, just in case we see something interesting to shoot at, and we hop into his pickup. We have driven up and down those back roads, trying to locate the abandoned farm I saw on the day of my father's funeral, the broken windmill, the remnants of a foundation of a two-room house, the stand of trees and the falling fences. Although my brother says he believes me each time I describe the place, he and I have never been able to find it. Chapter 2. The Land Husband. I owe my existence to rain, to the strong, uncaring rain that my mother walked home in from her waitressing job one evening in 1948, from which my father rescued her by offering her a ride. Conception through the agency of water comes as a blessing in a place that yields only 16 inches of precipitation a year. More likely to be born to the endless dust or the incessant wind. Did he see her first as a woman rushing down the sidewalk with her collar pulled up around her neck? Did she turn at the small honk of a horn as the car pulled up to the curb? How much in life depends upon a sunny forecast with a rainy outcome, a forgotten umbrella? One turn down an anonymous street reveals a woman walking in the rain. An unknown street becomes the street. One offer turns into a lifetime of offers. My mother doesn't remember the make or model of the car, but she remembers the offer from this man, my father, 7 years her senior, but still young and good-looking. Years before he met my mother, my father danced his way through World War II. Scarred lungs from a childhood bout with pneumonia made him unsuitable for military service. He had done his part stateside, filling up the dance cards of all the local girls whose beaux had flown off to the South Pacific and the European theater. By 1948, when my parents met, he was managing a bar on Main Street, which is how he spotted her, the new girl from a neighboring town, working in the local cafe. My father was small-boned, with dark hair and blue eyes. Pictures of the time reveal he was as handsome as Cary Grant, but he was shorter, lean, and graceful like Fred Astaire. My mother says that when they first started dating, she had difficulty getting a dance with him when they went out. So many women had prior claims to him as a dance partner. The war was over. The beaux had come home and were now husbands, but they were no more graceful than when they'd gone off to fight. The problem was the polka. My mother could not master it. She tried to learn the dance, but there was a missing step she could not identify, and my father would not be bothered to show her, that kept her from gliding as smoothly as all the other women when they danced with my father. Every weekend my mother sat forlornly on the benches surrounding the dance floor, a stranger in this new town, watching her date, my father, whirl by again and again in the laughing arms of more light-footed women. Finally, another man from town took pity on her, lifted her to her feet, and showed her the hidden step, the half-hop in mid-step, that would create the appearance of floating. If not for this kind man, it's possible that none of us children would have been born. My father was an elderly bachelor of 27 at the time. My mother was 20. Despite my father's dancing prowess, his graceful frame belied a history of delicate health. The case of pneumonia at 3 years old had filled his lungs with fluid, causing the doctor to pronounce his case hopeless and abandon his treatment. My father had lingered near death. And this appears to be a good place, a suspenseful place, to end our reading for today. We are reading The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, by Deborah Marquardt, professor and coordinator of the Creative Writing Program at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. I'm Mary Richards, producer of this program, The Community Bookshelf, which you can hear on KHOI-FM every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening at this time. Thanks to Janet Kloss, production assistant, and to our program engineer, Ron Latson, and to you for listening. You can hear prior episodes of this book, by finding our page on the KHOI website.